door and could see the shadow of 2 feet shifting impatiently. It was morning then. He must have slept about 12 hours. He wasn't even undressed. Durand went to the curtain and peered through. Desai was out front preparing to pound on the door again. The man held a plastic bag and a cardboard tray of takeout coffee. Durand opened the door and stepped aside. Desai entered quickly, locking the door behind him.
Koni lubang pantat betola. I've been hammering on the door for 5 minutes.
I was asleep.
More like a second coma.
Durand stretched and looked in the mirror. He noticed that the majority of his bruises seemed to have faded in the night.
Well, you look better at any rate.
Desai peered through the door's peephole warily. Satisfied, he turned and offered a coffee cup and a plastic bag sealed with a strip of raffia.
I bring refreshment.
Durand grabbed the bag, tearing it open.
Excellent. Roti Chennai, thank you.
He dipped the grilled, flaky flatbread into a container of lamb curry that came with it, then paused.
Is this deathless?
Desai raised an eyebrow.
You're a Deegan? You surprise me, Mr. Durand. But yes, it is cultured lamb.
Durand tucked in and spoke with an overstuffed mouth.
Thank you.
He chewed noisily.
Go slow. Your system might still be in distress.
Durand suddenly realized that the food tasted odd to him. He slowed his chewing.
What?
This doesn't taste right.
It's from the best mamak stall in Johor, man.
Durand smelled the curry again.
Oh, God.
Desai snapped his fingers.
I bet your taste buds have changed, too. That must be it.
Durand closed his eyes. When will this end?
Fascinating. You must have the taste buds of this Wicks fellow. Things you once enjoyed may no longer be palatable to you, or at least they may taste differently.
Yeah, fascinating. Durand resumed eating. He was just too hungry. Roti Chennai was among his favorites, but this simply tasted okay. Even that small pleasure had been robbed from him.
Arrangements have been made.
How and where? Durand opened the coffee lid and scowled at the contents. This isn't coffee.
Soya chinchao. You Americans call it a Michael Jackson. Soy milk with little strands of grass jelly.
Whatever. Maybe Wicks will like it. Durand took a sip. To his consternation, he did like it.
There's an autonomous hire car waiting in the alley out back to take you north.
A car? To Thailand? That's at least 1,000 kilometers.
It's 2,000 to Pattaya City, but the car is just to the state of Kelantan here in Malaysia. There, you'll be hidden in a truck by smuggler friends of mine and smuggled over the border.
I won't get that far. Hire cars have interior cameras, facial recognition. I won't get out of Johor.
Desai patted him on the back. This isn't Singapore, Mr. Durand. The car service is owned by smugglers. This car makes a trip up the coast a couple times a week. There'll be some contraband in the panels, but that's the price of pseudonymous travel.
Still eating, he cast an annoyed look at Desai. Don't even start with me, Rod.
Custom plant embryos in cryo. Nothing to be overly concerned about.
I'm trying to avoid the police, not attract them.
Smugglers make their living with the cooperation of the police. This way, you're just another mule among many. Your journey will arouse no suspicion.
Durand considered this. What did you tell your smuggler friends about me?
Only that I've a shipment and an associate willing to go along with it. It saves them the trouble of finding a mule. Empty hire cars on long-distance runs are routinely stolen.
Durand tossed the bag in the trash as he finished the roti chennai. Why not a boat across the Gulf of Thailand like all these refugees? A straight shot. The Gulf is risky, and I have no contacts with human traffickers.
Still, the Malaysian Peninsula is crawling with climate refugees. The southern provinces of Thailand are under martial law. Muslim separatists, bombings, there are military checkpoints. It's not exactly a Sunday drive.
It's not a war. It's just a zone of heightened security is all. Thai soldiers are looking for terrorists, not smugglers, which is why they accept bribes. You'll be on the back of a military truck all through southern Thailand.
Durand contemplated this. How many days?
2, 3 at the most?
Durand had to admit that it sounded like a reasonable plan. He stood. What's in the other bag?
Oh.
Desai opened the bag he held in his hand and produced a theatrical-quality hairpiece with dramatic sideburns.
I thought it best to alter your appearance. I've a friend who works for a low-budget film studio near here.
Durand went to the mirror and tried on the hairpiece. He turned this way and that. He resembled a Eurasian Clint Eastwood. Desai passed him a false mustache and a container of spirit gum.
Really? A mustache?
You want to look as different as possible to casual inspection.
Durand used the spirit gum to affix the mustache and then slipped on the mirror glasses Desai had given him the day before. Looking at his reflection, he now resembled a Bollywood action hero.
Won't fool near-infrared facial recognition systems.
Of which there are few to zero in rural Malaysia.
Nor is it likely to fool the police.
Then don't talk to any.
Stepping out into the morning heat, Desai led Durand around the side of the prefab microtel to an alley where a budget autonomous car was parked. The humidity, even this early, was stifling. A fetid stew of odors emanated from nearby overflowing dumpsters. It was gag-inducing. Crowds of Bangladeshi and Burmese immigrants, lucky enough to have found illegal employment, walked through the alley on their way to work. Desai extended his hand to bump bit rings with a preteen kid who was sitting on the car, apparently watching it. With that, the kids scurried off.
Here we are.
Durand examined a blue-grown shell chitin car wedged in with a row of other poorly parked vehicles, part of the haphazard pattern of life in Johor. The car was a two-seater, a popular low-budget model called a shrimp, because the body was grown from the same chitinous material as shrimp shells. Painting them wasn't necessary since they were grown with their shells in many colors. Lightweight, strong, eventually biodegradable. This one was blue with a mother-of-pearl iridescence and OLED headlamps. Desai waved a prepaid credit fob to unlock it and then handed the fob to Durand, who climbed inside. Glancing around, he saw no one taking any notice of them. But then, almost everyone in the city seemed to be from somewhere else. Desai handed Durand a new phablet device.
Take this and give me that old one.
Durand hesitated.
Why?
Because I've loaded a substantial amount into a digital wallet on this one. You can access the funds here.
He pointed.
For God's sake, secure it with a passkey. I've given you far more money than you'll need, just in case anything goes wrong. But I expect to be paid back.
Durand handed over the junkie's phablet and took the new one.
I can also track that device in a pinch if I need to, although I'm going to avoid that if at all possible. I'm not keen on being linked to you.
Durand nodded. Desai offered his hand.
I wish you luck in returning to your former self, Mr. Durand.
Durand took Desai's hand and shook it.
I appreciate your help, Rod. I really do. If you succeed, remember, we could convert this live editing technology into billions of American dollars. The three of us. Literally billions, Mr. Durand. Imagine retiring young to your own compound.
Durand stared coldly for a moment, then smiled tightly. I'll bear that in mind. Desai shut the door. He saluted, then merged into the foot traffic passing around the shrimp. Durand looked at the vehicle number on the front visor and spoke to the car without taking his eyes off Desai.
Comcar 6362, start current journey.
A synthetic voice with a male Indian accent said in English,
Commencing journey from Johor Bahru to Endau. Estimated travel time, 2 hours and 19 minutes. Charge to your SINCO card. Please relax and enjoy your journey. You can request to pull over at any time by announcing unscheduled stop. Stops will incur extra charges.
A digital map appeared on a cheap video sticker screen adhered, slightly crooked, to the car's dashboard. No light field projectors here. The interior was as low budget as they came. The car began to roll forward, lightly honking its horn to alert the undocumented workers to make way. Advertisements started playing on the map screen almost immediately. There was no mute button. The tiny, bulbous shrimp car cruised among other autonomous and manually driven cars and trucks on the AH-18, headed north and out of the dense urban sprawl of Johor. Morning rush hour was a mix of crowded autonomous buses, a few shrimp cars like his own, and colorful dump trucks and freight haulers, most still diesel. The curving windows of the shrimp didn't give Durand much privacy. He suspected this was by design. Malaysian society was fairly conservative, and providing roving rental rooms for sexual trysts wasn't going to happen. Thus, the budget comcars were wide open to public view. Durand lowered the bush hat over his face as if nodding off, though he couldn't help gazing through his fingers at the world passing by. A huge building boom in Johor had been sparked by the rocketing fortunes of Singapore across the strait, doubling Johor's population in the past 2 decades, what real estate agents called Singapore adjacent. As Durand gazed through the windshield, the malls, condos, and chain restaurants went on for kilometers, many of them named in English. Though he recognized few of the brands, the signage looked similar to almost everywhere, as did the sleek retail fronts. It occurred to Durand that perhaps this sort of consumer culture was just a natural consequence of modernity, that perhaps it had nothing to do with American culture. Modern civilization created convenience and comfort, and this is what that looked like. What was once dense, malarial jungle was now condos, malls, office towers, and golf courses. The burgeoning cities of Africa were much the same. The inevitable poor walked past robotic construction equipment, selling fruit or begging for alms. The modern world no longer needed manual labor, at least not labor anyone was willing to pay for. Durand wondered where it would all lead. It was the main reason he and Miyuki had striven to get Mia into the best schools. Specialized knowledge, after all, was what had saved him from his fate as the North American middle class shriveled away. Specialized knowledge was the way you became an expat instead of a refugee. After 30 minutes or so, the shrimp cleared the outskirts of Johor Bahru. Here, the road narrowed to just 2 lanes and traffic thinned out considerably. The landscape was relatively flat. Telecommunication towers, the occasional jungle-choked hill, and broad mud-brown rivers separated defunct palm oil plantations with fading signage and tattered fence lines. The sound of the Adhan, the Muslim call to prayer, could be heard over loudspeakers in the distance. The tiny car rolled through small towns of mildewed buildings with peeling paint. It looked as though there were hard economic times hereabouts. Rain clouds loomed ahead. Monsoons were unreliable lately, but when they came with a vengeance. Judging by the blackness of the clouds and occasional flashes of lightning ahead, they were going to be torrential today. The first fat raindrops began to pound down on the bulbous windshield. Disquietingly, the comm car did not have windshield wipers. That would have required another maintenance item, wiper blades, and economy cars didn't bother with such niceties. He was quickly blind to the road ahead. With one last glance at the blurry, expressionistic view of cascading water, Durand tried to doze off, despite an annoying parade of ads on the dashboard screen. He concentrated on the sound of heavy rain, amazed at how exhausted his body still was even after 12 hours' sleep. His traumatic physical transformation had no doubt taken its toll. Perhaps he had not yet fully healed. Durand awoke some time later to the sound of clicking on his side window. He jerked up to see a mix of Burmese and Bangladeshi men with their hands cupped, faces pressed against the window glass. They each wore a colorful lungi, a simple kilt-like cloth tied at the waist by a twist knot, and clicked bit rings against the windshield for his attention. Some were shirtless, but others wore t-shirts bearing the logos of sport brands or cartoon characters with Chinese text. The moment they noticed Durand was awake, they started calling out in beseeching voices.
40 ringgit, sir! Ringgit to travel, sir!
Why the car wasn't moving was a mystery. The rain had stopped. It was partly sunny out. He glanced at the clock on the dashboard screen. He was 2 hours out of Johor, apparently in the countryside on a rural stretch of the AH-18 lined with palm oil plantations. In the middle of the roadway in front of the shrimp stood half a dozen young men with bare feet and cheap phablets. A couple even had low-end LFP glasses. They blocked the way. The comm car's horn beeped lightly several times, but was ignored. A truck horn howled from behind as it crossed the middle line and passed by Durand's stopped vehicle, causing it to shudder. The refugees ignored the truck, apparently knowing full well that trying to stop a human-driven truck would get them killed. But they knew algorithms. Algorithms could be counted upon to stop if human beings stood in the middle of the roadway.
40 ringgit, sir!
A Bangladeshi man in his early 40s, sporting a graying beard, clicked his bit ring against the window. Durand realized to his dismay that this group wasn't going to move unless he paid them. And looking up ahead at the empty road, he could see dozens more refugee groups moving in the tree line. The smoke of cook fires was visible in the distance as well. This was going to be a long damn ride. The refugees clicked their bit rings again on the window.
Sir, 50 ringgit, sir. Please, 50 ringgit to travel.
The price was rising the more he waited. They knew their business. Durand nodded and held up one hand. He pulled out the phablet Desai had given him and accessed his digital wallet. He wished he had a set of LFP glasses so he could do this in AR, but after clicking clumsily around, he transferred several 50-ringgit-sized chunks of chai coin to one of his bit rings. Each bump should transfer 50 ringgit, with a delay between for safety. He found a window slot and pulled its handle back to create a small opening. Apparently, panhandling had been anticipated. Either that, or it was meant to pass ID to the police. The 40-ish bearded man was the first in line. He was sinewy, with chocolate-brown skin, and what looked to be a nasty machete scar on his forearm. His jet-black hair was streaked with gray. He bumped bit rings with Durand, then checked his phablet device. He nodded and caused the phablet to speak for him in a synthetic English translation.
Bless you, sir. Long life to you.
Several more young men pushed in to bump rings with Durand, but after a certain point, the 40-ish man pushed them away, shouting. He then motioned with his hand, whistling. He was clearly their leader. Looking ahead, Durand could see the men on the road had not moved aside.
Hey, I paid you.
The group leader spoke quickly as young men around him rushed to a ditch by the side of the road.
Durand waved his arms. Get out of the way! I paid you!
He picked up the phablet and repeated the command, translating it into Bengali and then into Burmese. Three or four young men ran up to the shrimp on all sides. Suddenly, a loud bang startled Durand. It was followed by squeaking. The car rocked, and Durand looked up at the glass ceiling to see two makeshift benches linked with cord straps had been tossed like a saddle over the bulbous car's body.
You have got to be kidding me.
Durand pounded on the side window himself.
Get that off my car!
He was about to unbuckle and go out to muscle them off when he heard a shout. The sinewy older man leaned up to the window and spoke into his own device. It repeated in English,
If not us, there will be others.
He gestured down the road. Durand's gaze followed, and he realized the man was right. Hundreds of migrants lined the road ahead. Young men started piling on to the bench ledges, clambering onto Durand's car, rocking it severely. One boy, wearing a tattered e-sports t-shirt, still stood in front of the comm car to keep it from driving on while the others piled on top. Durand stared at the kid who couldn't have been more than 12. The kid stared back, then smiled. Finally, a shout went up, and the kid moved aside. The comm car began to move, and the boy ran for the outstretched hands of his comrades as they pulled him up and onto the top of the little car. An alarm went off on the shrimp, and a synthetic voice warned,
Car overloaded! Car overloaded!
A pause.
At the current payload, energy surcharges will apply. Recharge stops being recalculated.
Of course.
Durand leaned back in his seat as the comm car slowly and laboriously accelerated with its new passengers. He had to hand it to the refugees. They were resourceful. Preying on autonomous vehicles like ticks would never have been tolerated in Singapore, but Malaysia had a long coastline and millions of people were on the move. The law was stretched thin here. Dirt-covered bare feet now dangled over the windshield. The men and boys outside the car were involved in a raucous discussion in several languages, pointing at distant objects, sharing food, poring over their phablet devices. They were a networked tribe, and now that they'd scored a ride, they all but ignored Durand. Well, it was a good cover, wasn't it? Durand realized he now looked more like a harried tourist than a wanted cartel leader. More refugees loomed out of the bush on the road ahead, but as they tried to step into the roadway and cause the car to stop to beg for money, Durand's passengers shouted at them, and the newcomers beat a retreat back into the tree line. The car continued down the highway, still gaining speed. So his ticks were useful at least. A symbiotic relationship, then. Durand settled in for a long journey. Chapter 19. After traveling for another half hour, Durand grew concerned about his vehicle. The shrimp was driving slower and slower with its extra passengers, apparently to conserve charge. They hadn't passed any liquid metal battery stations in a while. The shrimp's video screen didn't give him access to a charge indicator either. The roads in Singapore had chargers built into the surface, and the distances were short. but this budget comcar company apparently considered passengers freight, and freight had no need to know the status of its vehicle. Suddenly, two young men on the roof hung down from the benches, waving their feet before the car's bumper. The LIDAR sensors triggered, bringing the car to a sudden, lurching halt. The two men leaped off and stood in front of the car as others hurled bundles and packs down to them. The rest of the men jumped down, and they began unharnessing their makeshift benches. Durand was apparently losing his tics. He watched with curiosity as they disembarked. Beyond them was actual jungle. Not palm oil plantations, but wild trees and undergrowth. A glance at the map indicated they had just entered the Gunung Arang National Coastal Forest. He could see many more cooking fires in the distance. The 40-something leader of the ticks approached the side window, leaning down. He tapped his fingers to his forehead and bowed greeting, then held up his phablet device. As he spoke, the device translated his words. "It may not matter to you, but there is a police checkpoint ahead. Not immigration. Sirius National Police." Durand sat up straight and looked ahead. There was a curve in the road not far on. He could see only trees. The man pointed.
3 kilometers north. Our people have eyes on the coastal highway."
This explained why his ticks were bailing on him. Durand decided to pay more attention to the behavior of these refugees. They seemed to have a solid information network. A digital diaspora of mobile intelligence. The man slapped the side of the shrimp affectionately, nodded again to Durand. Then he and his people crossed a drainage ditch, heading into the jungle. As the last refugee moved aside, Durand's car began to move once more. He spoke immediately. "Unscheduled stop." The car replied,
"Unscheduled stop requested. Pulling over at the next safe location."
But the car did not stop. Instead, it kept moving forward slowly, its LIDAR scanning the narrow shoulder for some place to get clear of the traffic lane, its hazard lights blinking.
"Screw it."
Durand opened the shrimp's door. Alarms went off. Durand jumped clear, running to a stop. He then looked back at the group of refugees heading into the jungle. The 40-something leader of the Bangladeshis noticed Durand and motioned for him to follow. Durand gazed back at the autonomous shrimp, which was locked in some sort of ethical dilemma. It had lost its passenger, but without an obstruction in front, its algorithms were escalating the priority to pull clear of traffic lanes, which wasn't possible on the narrow road. He left the AI to its shuddering confusion and instead leaped over the dry drainage ditch. He approached the jungle edge, and the older refugee placed a hand on his chest and spoke into his device. The phablet's dry artificial voice said,
"My name is Mahfuz."
He gestured to two younger Bangladeshi men in their early 20s standing next to him. One was wiry and in good health, the other smaller with facial scars.
"My nephews, Abul and Azam."
Durand nodded to them. He produced his own phablet and fumbled for the translation app. It was already open. He spoke into it.
"Call me..."
He hesitated.
"Jim."
Mahfuz nodded to him, repeating,
"Mr. Jim."
"Thank you for the warning. I don't have papers."
The computer voice translated. He gazed down the path.
"Where does this lead?"
Mahfuz motioned for Durand to follow, and they all moved under the cover of the jungle, following a path worn by many others. Mahfuz spoke into his device.
"There is a migrant camp 8 kilometers away. You can obtain food, medical care, lots of people from many places there."
Durand fell in behind the men. They walked in stifling heat and humidity. Mahfouz and his nephews insisted on sharing their water bottles with Durand. He became increasingly grateful, especially as the path began to climb a steep jungle hillside, the only hill he'd seen in a while. Sometime near sunset, they reached the crest of a ridge, and there was a break between young dipterocarp trees. Mahfouz waited on the trail for Durand, and then pointed down on the lowland plain and the highway. He offered a ping-pong ball-sized thumb cam to Durand. Durand lifted its viewfinder level with his eye and scrolled the zoom wheel. Molecular lenses with no moving parts were dirt cheap now, available all over. It still amazed him how broadly technology had diffused. He zoomed in on a police checkpoint several kilometers below. Dozens of vehicles blocked the highway. Military tents stood nearby. Satellite dishes. Generators. The vehicles bore the insignia of the Royal Malaysian Police. Anti-terror units stood by out of sight from the road. It was a major op. Durand removed his eye from the lens. Mahfouz studied him closely. The man knew more about what was really going on in this region than either Durand or Radea Desai. That much was clear. Durand held up his hands as if clueless. Mahfouz collected his thumb cam, and they walked on. They hiked down into a shallow jungle valley, and Durand saw the dark shadow of the South China Sea over the next rise. Lights of resort islands off the Malaysian coast twinkled as the sun set at their backs. Closer at hand, in the jungle below them, white LED lights glowed beneath the tree canopy. The voice of a muezzin announced the Maghrib, the evening call to prayer, on a loudspeaker somewhere. Abul and Azam glanced to their uncle. He spoke softly to them, and they continued down the path. It wasn't until darkness fell that they reached the edge of a large migrant camp. Here, hundreds of refugees were bedding down beneath plastic tarps. As Durand passed through, he saw faces and heard languages from all over the world. Yemenis, Syrians, Afghans, Iraqis, Cambodians, Laotians, Vietnamese, Filipinos, New Guineans. It was an incredibly diverse group. Here was Inspector Marcotte's briefing come to life. Observing the weary, dejected faces, Durand knew these people had no choice but to take their chances and hope that something broke their way. Perhaps they had family beyond a border somewhere, someone who could sponsor them. But he suspected that too often even the cousin or uncle in Africa or China couldn't help. There were fewer jobs all over these days, and refugee camps grew on the borders of everywhere. And yet nearly all of the refugees huddled with their devices in the darkness, their sole link to scattered families, scouting the world for a place to call home. As Durand, Mahfouz, and his nephews neared the center of the camp, they saw a red crescent flag on the side of a large white kitchen tent. People there queued up for food. A medical clinic stood nearby in a separate tent. Work lights starkly illuminated the area with swarms of bugs circling beneath. A multi-ethnic crowd of migrants stood near the tents debating something, each of them holding up devices to translate a dozen languages as they shouted simultaneously, pointing and gesturing passionately, while dispassionate robot voices on their handhelds tried to make sense of this modern Tower of Babel. Mahfouz gestured to the group and spoke to Durand through his own phablet. The device repeated in English, "There is no path to Johor or Kuala Lumpur. Immigration police. Some will try for Jakarta, but without money, they will not get far." Durand spoke into his device. "Where are you and your nephews headed?" A delay as the device translated. "That is a question we are asking ourselves." Durand studied the grim, mostly male faces of the migrants. The journey was no doubt unsafe. Robberies and extortion common. He guessed they would send for their families only when they'd secured a place somewhere, anywhere, and set aside enough money to bring family by safer means. He realized his own personal crisis was just another in an ocean of calamities. Every person here faced a seemingly insurmountable obstacle, and this was just one camp. The only difference was that he had money. Desai said he'd loaded a ChiCoin account for emergency use. Its transactions were tracked by the People's Bank of China, but that was hardly a problem short-term, and the account holder was presumably fictitious. Azam motioned for his uncle, brother, and Durand to follow. They joined the Chow line. Clearly nothing else was available out here. After a considerable wait, they emerged with cultured plastic bowls of steamed rice, tofu, greens, and bottled water, passed to them by aid workers. The same volunteers were also handing out pocket chemical stoves, rations wrapped in biodegradable plastic, apparently an effort by Malaysian authorities to stave off waves of immigrants burning wood and hunting in the national forest. After they had eaten, Mahfuz chatted softly with his nephews in Bengali. Durand kept his translator app turned off to allow them privacy. It was clear they were working through some difficulties. The young men sounded despondent, but they were also tired, and soon they rolled on their sides to sleep on the still moist ground. Lots of refugees around them were doing the same, whole constellations of device screens winking off. Durand slapped mosquitoes off his neck. Then he heard Mahfuz speak softly in his direction. The man's device translated into English. "What are you, Mr. Jim? A smuggler?" Durand looked up to see reflected screen light illuminating Mahfuz's eyes in the darkness. Durand spoke into his own device. "Same as you. I need to get somewhere, and I don't have documents." A murmuring of Bengali, followed by, "You had a private car." "It was owned by smugglers. I was just a mule."
"They will be angry with you."
"I don't care. I need to get to Thailand."
"Borders mean little to gangs, and they do not forgive debts."
Durand almost laughed. If the man only knew. He looked more intently at Mahfuz. "Do you have family back home?"
There was a moment of silence. Then, "My entire remaining family is there."
Mahfuz looked down at the young men.
"We spent all we had to reach Penang, but I did not want my nephews to get indebted, so we remain."
"Indebted? To traffickers?"
Mahfuz nodded grimly. "Abul has an architecture degree. Azam was pursuing a degree in engineering. What does it matter? There is no work outside the cities."
They sat in silence for a time. A commotion began in the center of camp. It looked like a convoy of electric all-terrain cycles was moving through. A whining Nafiri combined with thumping techno music synchronized to laser lights awoke the camp. Lights flashed through the trees. There was shouting in many languages. Mahfuz gestured and spoke into his device.
"Traffickers, they come at night when their boats leave. They will promise work, but only the foolish get in their debt."
Durand watched the commotion. The laser lights whirled. It certainly drew attention. "I have no intention of getting in their debt," he stood, "because I have money." Durand opened up his phablet. "Mahfuz, what's a reasonable sum for me to pay traffickers to reach northern Thailand?" Mahfuz was taken aback.
"From here?"
He thought for a moment.
"They will probably want at least 20,000 ringgit, half up front, half on arrival. But you must give them the transfer code for the second half on arrival, or you will never escape. They may cheat you still, and admit to no family, say you are alone in the world, or they may kidnap you for ransom. Keep your bank codes memorized. Write nothing down. Durand checked his Chicoin account.
They bring people by boat?
They will bring you out to one of the trawlers supplying the fishing fleets. But do not board a fishing boat, no matter what you do. And do not ever board a container ship, especially those at anchor in international waters. These they call hulks, because they never move.
Durand tapped at his device. What's on the hulks?
Factories. They seal slaves into the shipping containers. Make them assemble devices like the one in your hand. I'm told it's even cheaper than factory robots, because they do not feed anyone. No one leaves alive.
Durand stared at Mahfuz in shock. How could that be happening? What about the Coast Guard or...
In international waters, the disposable are disposed of. No one wishes to know.
Durand shook his head. His own problems seemed so insignificant amid all this.
He then looked back down at his phablet.
Desai had made a substantial sum available for emergencies. It was time to put it to good use.
Durand transferred about $10,000 worth onto one of his several bitrings. After receiving a confirmation code, he handed the bitring to Mahfuz.
Mahfuz looked warily at Durand. There should be enough on here to get you and your nephews into either Johor or Kuala Lumpur to buy documentation.
You would have us be in your debt?
Durand had forgotten how menacing he could appear. He shook his head. I am in your debt, Mahfuz. Consider this repayment. Still wary, Mahfuz took the ring and touched it to his own. He then checked his phablet to confirm the amount it held. After a moment, he looked up. He placed his hand to his heart and lowered his device, speaking man to man.
Balo takmen, Mr. Jim. Jani deka hobe.
Deriving the sentiment from the tone and solemnity, Durand nodded. He then turned and walked toward the music and whirling laser lights of the traffickers.
Chapter 20. Durand stood on a stone pier in darkness on the shore of the South China Sea. The coast curled away in both directions to form a sizable cove hemmed in by steep jungle hills devoid of lights. Wispy casuarina trees sighed from an onshore breeze, their trunks extending into the gentle waves. Semi-submerged huts and abandoned resort cabins stood in the water as well. Parking lot signs stood half-submerged. The water had indeed risen over the decades. Malaysia was relatively lucky. Low-lying, heavily populated countries like Bangladesh were in a much deeper crisis. The night was moonless, but Durand gazed up at the brilliant field of stars above, the Milky Way at the edge of his vision. Around him, the jungle thrummed with insects and whooping nightbirds. He felt eager to reach his destination, to see this deed done. Close by, an Indian teenager in stylish clothes sat on an electric all-terrain cycle. He'd used it to bring Durand through the jungle trails to this location, but right now the kid was playing an invisible AR game through his designer LFP glasses, ignoring the breathtakingly beautiful night around them. Durand heard the crunching of tires over gravel, and soon an electric SUV rolled into view through the trees. It moved like a shadow through a half-submerged parking lot and came to a halt at the end of the stone pier. Several people got out. They removed luggage from the cargo area. Before long, they approached, and Durand's companion turned off his LFP game, sitting up straight. The kid's boss had evidently arrived. Four men joined them. two dour-looking Malays in wide-collared shirts, shorts, and sandals. The other two, clearly paying passengers, like Durand. The first was a portly Hoklo man in his 60s wearing a white suit that almost phosphoresced in the starlight. He clutched a Panama hat to his head while his tie flopped around in the breeze. A businessman jumping bail? A dirty politician on the lam? Anybody's guess. The second passenger was a 20-something Thai man with spiked hair, wireless piercings, designer LFPs, and trendy clothing. A long-tailed macaque crawled around his shoulders, chattering. The man clutched a refrigerated metal case in one hand. Durand knew that a case like that could hold 1,000 microscopic samples of proprietary synbio lifted from firms in Singapore, Johor, or Kuala Lumpur. And this one probably did. Lights flashed in the forest, and soon the low silhouette of an electric cigarette boat glided silently across the cove like an eel. A crew of two stood in the black boat, and they brought the vessel alongside the pier with practiced ease, not even bothering to tie it off. The traffickers on the pier slid a small ramp out onto it. Then they motioned for Durand and the others to board. As he descended, Durand felt something sharp scratch across his forearm. He looked down and could see a shallow scratch on his skin, visible even by starlight. What the hell was that? One of the Malays was busy inserting something into a small device.
DNA sample. Get ass on board.
The other trafficker scraped a skin sample from the next passenger. Durand looked back down at his arm.
Hey, shit for brains.
It was an Australian accent. The pilot of the boat was a young Aussie in cargo shorts and LFPs sporting a night vision nodule. Standing next to him was a wiry Filipino man. An old Scorpion machine pistol hung on a strap at his chest and a metal-detecting wand in his hand. He spoke Aussie lingo with a Filipino accent.
Oi, hold out your arms for scan.
With no room to argue, Durand stepped aboard. He held out his arms as the metal detection wand was waved over him.
He's clean.
The Filipino pushed him toward an open seat.
Sit down.
Durand sat. His grown knife had indeed passed through. No wonder they were illegal. He sat pondering the significance of the DNA sample that had just been taken from him. The seats were surprisingly comfortable, plush white faux leather upholstery. He guessed the boat was a stolen pleasure yacht. Perfect for smugglers. Low radar signature, quiet, no doubt fast. The second mate scanned the other two passengers with the detection wand as well, while the traffickers stowed the businessman's luggage on deck. The Thai man held his metal case close. The monkey crawled over him, though now it was clear it was on a leash.
If that monkey bites me, mate, I'm going to serve you monkey tartare on a fucking cracker. You hear me?
The Thai man spoke in heavily accented English.
Monkey does not bite.
The detector wand warbled on the businessman's coat, and the second mate pulled a .357 snub-nosed revolver from the man's belt.
Fuck's this?
Protection.
He shouted in the man's face.
You don't need protection. We your protection.
He shoved the man forward, passing the revolver to the Aussie pilot who placed it on the dash. The men on the pier pulled the ramp up. Without a word, the pilot brought the boat about. A whoosh of water jets, and the boat accelerated. An ocean breeze rolled over them, and they headed out into the South China Sea. Looking back, Durand watched the dark line of jungle recede. The smell of rotting vegetation faded with it. The wind picked up. Soon they were doing at least 35 knots. The pilot fastened a safety harness as the boat continued to pick up speed. Durand searched for his own seatbelt and fastened himself in. No one else appeared concerned. The silhouettes of mountainous islands rose a few kilometers ahead. The biggest of these, Durand knew from examining his phablet map, was Tioman, with a pair of rocky peaks about 50 kilometers out. It was visible only as a dark smudge on the horizon against a field of stars. Once they were clear of the cove and in open water, the powerful cigarette boat picked up even more speed, its electric water jets moving them at 60 knots or more. The boat had no dashboard lights or gauges. Durand guessed those were all beamed into the pilot's LFP glasses as virtual displays, though the boat did have a physical throttle and wheel. It skimmed across the surface of a calm sea, the wind whipping over them. The businessman's hat finally broke free of his grip and disappeared over the stern into darkness. The Filipino's second mate laughed as the elderly man cursed under his breath. Durand leaned down to activate his phablet map. At their current heading, they appeared to be aiming for Tioman. And at this speed, they'd reach it in just a half hour or so. And then, it was out into the open sea, and the supply trawler already moving north toward Thailand. Durand's mind wandered as the whine of the electric motors sent up a geyser behind them. He fixated on the phosphorescing water. Before he knew it, the rocky peaks of Tioman loomed in front of him, black silhouettes. The earthy scent of jungle reached them. He could see the lights of resorts stretching along its coastline. No doubt refugees were quickly whisked away from here. In 10 minutes, Tioman fell behind, and they headed out into the open water of the South China Sea. Durand started from a light snooze as the young Thai smuggler shouted against the wind, "There! Hulks!" Durand sat up and saw what appeared to be a glittering city ahead. There were hundreds of bright lights reflected on the water. After a few moments, he realized it was a flotilla of huge container ships moored in place. Smaller boats moved about between them. They were probably a kilometer or more away. The Thai man's monkey hunkered down at his feet, sheltering from the howling wind. But the young man pointed again and shouted to Durand, "Slave City!" Durand watched with disbelieving eyes as they passed the collection of rusting retired vessels. The ships were massive, and there must have been 40 or 50 of them, each 1,000 feet or more long, stretching to the horizon. The most distant ones were illuminated by flashes of far-off lightning. These also revealed dark, towering clouds. But the looming weather could wait. Durand instead focused on the hulks, decommissioned after the collapse of global shipping, no doubt. When he was a child, they'd transported the products of distant factories. Now, they were the factories. Even over the roar of the speedboat, he could hear voices on loudspeakers from the hulks, talking in a foreign language. Heavy machinery pounded rhythmically. Human forms moved along the railings, men with guns. Cranes lowered containers onto ships, while others lifted containers from ships. How many flotillas like this were in the oceans? How many refugees were disappearing in transit, never to be heard from again? Durand checked his device and noticed there was no signal. Or perhaps they had jammers. This place was beyond calls for help. His own boat powered on, heading farther out to sea. After 5 minutes or so, Durand heard the water jets rev down, and the cigarette boat's speed reduced by half, and then half again. Durand turned to see the pilot studying something unseen in his own LFP glasses. Apparently, the man had a satellite uplink. He had that blank virtual presence stare. A moment later, he looked up and focused on Durand. The pilot reduced the boat's speed again and motioned for the second mate to come close. Durand felt a surge of adrenaline. The two men conferred, and at one point, the Filipino glanced furtively over at Durand, too. The Hoklo businessman shouted from a forward seat,
"Why we stop? Let's get moving."
The pilot was reading something in his LFP glasses again.
"You're confused, mate. I'm in charge here."
The boat began to turn, looping around to head back toward the hulks, still glowing a couple kilometers behind them. Durand spotted lights moving out from the hulks to meet them. Boats. The Hoklo man shouted again,
"Why are we turning around? The trawler is north. My associate is on board."
The second mate now brandished the scorpion, aiming it.
"Shut up!"
The man blanched. The young Thai pulled his macaque up onto his shoulder.
"You know who I'm with?"
"I said shut up, asshole!"
Durand felt a renewed rush of adrenaline. He unclipped his seatbelt and stood, gazing out toward the lights of distant boats coming to meet them. They were still at least a click away. The Filipino unsteadily aimed the scorpion at him as the boat rolled through the waves.
"Big fish, eh? They want for you. They pay big."
Durand felt an eerie calm as the adrenaline bathed him with clarity. He knew without having to see. He could feel them on his skin, his marks revealing themselves. The second mate lowered the gun slightly as a look of shock came across his face.
"Holy shit! You seeing this, Mackie?"
The pilot stared in shock at Durand. The boat pitched sideways as it hit another wave, and in that moment, Durand launched himself at the pilot. He brought his hand up with the grown knife already in his grip. The pilot, still strapped into his seat, came up with the businessman's .357 revolver. Durand caught the man's wrist and buried the knife under his armpit. There was a loud crack from the pistol. Durand glanced back to see the Hoklo businessman roll sideways on a seat, choking as blood spread on his shirt front. The macaque screeched, and the Thai man dove for the deck, covering his head. Durand turned toward the second mate, who struggled to maintain his footing as he brought the scorpion to bear. The boat rolled through another wave. Durand grabbed a metal rail and jammed the throttle forward. Everyone else slid sternward. The businessman's choking body slid across the deck and slammed into the second mate, followed by the Thai smuggler. Only the monkey held on, climbing into a storage cabinet. Durand rolled the wheel, turning the cigarette boat in an arc away from the approaching searchlights and the hulks in the distance, on a heading back north. The boat now roared ruthlessly over waves, thumping over the ridge of each and making it difficult to stand. Durand saw his own reflection in the windshield as a searchlight passed over the boat. Tattoos covered Durand's neck and chest now. They were as dark as he'd ever seen them. He felt as fierce as he looked. The dead Aussie pilot was still strapped into his harness, and Durand drew the grown knife from the sucking wound in the man's chest. Durand then moved sternward, using handholds, toward the pile of men struggling to their feet. The Thai kid clambered away from the Filipino second mate, who himself was trying to get out from under the portly businessman. Blood stained the white upholstery and decking. The second mate crawled free of the dead businessman just as Durand reached him, and they all lost contact with the deck as the boat impacted another wave. They landed on the deck hard, and both Durand's knife and the scorpion fell away. The macaque screeched somewhere. Durand grabbed the second mate's arm. But the Filipino drew a knife from his own belt and tried to stab Durand in the chest. Durand's new reflexes surprised him. His hand shot out and twisted the mate's wrist. The knife clattered to the deck. Durand headbutted him. They both rolled, kicking and punching each other, tumbling over the businessman's body. Multiple searchlights were on them now. Loudspeaker voices shouted angrily in a foreign language. Duran screamed as he pulled the second mate's head back from behind. He spotted the grown knife rolling past on the deck. He grabbed it, plunging the razor-sharp claw into the second mate's shoulder blade. The second mate screamed,
"I fucking kill you! I kill you!"
Duran repeatedly plunged the knife into the man's back, feeling the air leaving his punctured lungs. But he kept stabbing. He lost track of how many times. Duran felt the strength in this new body. Blood ran down his own nose, and he shoved the body of the second mate onto the deck, then buried the knife in the back of the man's skull. Duran stared at the dead eyes of the Hoklo businessman who lay unblinking on the carbine decking, blood washing from side to side over him as the waves rocked the boat. The Thai smuggler screamed from somewhere as an ungodly bright searchlight played over the boat from one of the huge container ships. The air was white glare all around them. The cigarette boat roared onward, thundering through waves. A dead man at the helm. Tracer rounds snapped past. Duran pulled the grown knife out of the Filipino's skull and retracted its keratin blade, stowing it as he grabbed a handrail.